Exodus chapter 1, verse 15, to chapter 2, verse 10. The third talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on October 25, 2015, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 3, Exodus 1:15 to 2:10, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we're going to be continuing in Exodus. 2 weeks ago, I gave some introductory material, and last week we started in chapter 1. We did the first 14 verses. In those 14 verses, it begins talking about the fact that Jacob and his sons and their households made the move from Canaan to Egypt. And when they came down, there were 70 people that may have been a count of all the males, so it may have been a larger number than that, but it was a large family, extended family, that made the move from Canaan to Egypt. And that happened some time ago. All of them have died by the time that this narrative is picking up, but the population, that group, has grown significantly. That there are a lot of descendants of Israel that are now living in Egypt. So it's not just an extended family now. We now have enough human beings all related together that it can be called a people. And to any reader, that has to be striking, because if they have read Genesis, they know that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that their descendants would develop into a nation, would become very large, would become a people, and that that people would possess the land of Canaan, that God had given Canaan to Abraham and his descendants, and they would possess it. So as you're beginning in Exodus, you're seeing one of those promises being fulfilled, but the other one has not been fulfilled. And that's what Exodus is about, is God making steps towards fulfilling that other part of the promise that he had made to the patriarchs. Then in the next section, it tells us that a new king arose in Egypt. And I think that that's extremely significant, because what we're talking about is someone just coming to power, which means in the ancient world, in a power change, that the new ruler has to establish his legitimacy, his authority, and his power. So we have a king who's coming into power, who is in that kind of situation where he needs to establish himself in his position. And I think that that's what gives rise to what it describes following that, and that is the king of Egypt looks around and he sees a problem on the horizon. It's not a problem that is imminent, but there's this problem on the horizon, and that is there are a lot of Israelites, and someday Egypt might be attacked, and those Israelites would side with the enemy and fight against Egypt. So what Pharaoh suggests to all the people is that they will enslave the Israelites, and that those Israelites will be put to hard labor, and they will build some cities for the Pharaoh. And Pharaoh is accomplishing several things there. One is he's showing how wise he is in foreseeing problems and taking action to deal with those problems before they afflict the nation. But he is also commandeering a lot of wealth, that is, the manpower of this people group that he can put to use. And he's going to put it to use to build impressive buildings that will further buttress his power. So I think that's how we should make sense of what's going on there. They are enslaved then, but it doesn't have the effect that the Pharaoh had hoped. The Pharaoh had hoped that it would decrease the growth of the numbers of the Israelites. And the response of the Pharaoh was harder labor, to double down on his efforts to enslave them and use their labor. So that's where we left off. He's tried enslavement, and then he's tried bitter enslavement, and neither of those have worked. And in fact, it has made the situation worse. That now not only are there lots of Israelites, but there are lots of embittered Israelites. And that becomes a bigger problem. And I think that the Pharaoh is very conscious of that. Philip Ryken, in his commentary, makes an interesting comment here, and I will read it. It's in the notes if you have them. He says, Pharaoh's strategy for claiming sovereignty over Israel was slavery. In the Egyptian temple of Edfu, there is an inscription from the time of Ramses depicting a god registering slaves for Pharaoh. The picture is a reminder that by enslaving the Israelites, Pharaoh was trying to make a theological point. The Hebrews would not serve their own God. They would work for him. They would not be free to go to the land of God's promise. They would stay right where they were. In effect, Pharaoh was claiming to be the Lord of Israel. And by doing so, perhaps without even realizing it, he became the tool of Satan. The Exodus, therefore, was not simply an epic struggle between Moses and Pharaoh, or between Israel and Egypt. Ultimately, it was another skirmish in the great ongoing war between God and Satan. Okay, in the next section now, the Pharaoh is going to adopt a more aggressive strategy to deal with the Israelites, starting with verse 15. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other was named Puah. And he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? And the midwife said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous, and they give birth before the midwife can get to them. So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. And it came about, because the midwives feared God, that he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. So Pharaoh's strategy becomes more vicious than it had been before. This time he enlists the help of the midwives, the Hebrew midwives. Now, first of all, this is the first time that the word Hebrew is used in Exodus. It was used earlier in Genesis on a couple of occasions, and we'll see it used a few times here in the early part, especially of Exodus. And as I pointed out in my introductory material, that there are many references in the ancient writings to the Habiru or the Apiru, variously pronounced. But that seems to be a larger phenomenon than the Hebrews, but a related phenomenon. That is to say, they were people, were Western Semites, that is, people from the area of Canaan, and they seem to have had a certain kind of social, political status. They were kind of nomadic, and I liken them to the gypsies. They were an identifiable ethnic group, but they kind of wandered. They were somewhat nomadic, and they had a reputation for being warlike. Many of them were used as mercenaries. But there is also the connotation of being slave material, and they were often enslaved. And the Israelites seem to fit into that larger pattern. That is, the Israelites are a subset of the Habiru, But it was a very identifiable subset. So when the Israelites are talking to Egyptians or talking to other foreigners, they often identify themselves as Hebrews. And that seems to be the case in this section. Why is it that the Pharaoh would have called just two midwives? By even the most conservative estimates of the numbers of the sons of Israel at this time, it would have been far more than two midwives could have adequately served. So it has been suggested, and I think this is probably likely, that these two are the heads of the midwives, that there were probably many more midwives, and that these two organized their efforts and put them to work. The names of these two midwives are given, which is quite rare. It's quite rare for anybody's name to be given in a Hebrew narrative, in the Old Testament narratives. Names are not liberally thrown out. A person may be described, but it is unusual for them to be named, and that is generally significant. And I think that's significant here, that these are two women who are to be remembered, and we'll talk about that more later. The names of the women are both Hebrew names, names that have been found in other texts, probably not the same women. They seem to have been fairly common female names. Shifra means beauty, and Puah means fragrant blossom. The king, then, brings these two midwives, who are, even if they are the head of all of the midwives of the Israelites, these are not women of social prominence. These are not like a prince or priest or anyone of any major significance socially. So the Pharaoh has requested to speak to these low-ranking Israelite women, and he commands them that they are to kill any boy that is born to the Israelites. That is, when a child is born, if it is a boy, then the midwives are supposed to kill him, kill that boy. Now, it's interesting that he doesn't make any threats here. There's no indication of a threat. And I would be interested in knowing how he presents this to them. But in just thinking about it, my best guess is that he tried to use words to persuade them that this is somehow the right course of action. And I suggested two possibilities. One would be that it would be better for the Hebrews if there were fewer born. And a second, our goals can be met in a way that is most humane and least disruptive to society if you will just terminate the lives of these boys as they are born. I don't know if such appeal or any appeal like that was made, but it seems to me that it's not unlikely that he would have made some kind of appeal like that. However, whether he made this kind of appeal, and even if there were no threats stated, there was a huge threat that went unstated, and that is these women, these midwives, were in the presence of a human being that by Egyptian considered by Egyptian society to be a god. He isn't just a high-ranking official in the Egyptian government. He is considered to be genuinely a god. Now, that's true throughout the Middle East, that kings were genuinely seen as being the sons of a god. But in Egypt, they carried that a little further, and he was more divine-like than were the kings in Mesopotamia, for instance. So it had to be intimidating. There was an implied threat, whether any threat was made or not, and they had to have felt that. Why is it that the Pharaoh said to kill the boys and not the girls? And I don't know the answer to that. I can only speculate, but I assume that what he's thinking is the big threat to Egypt would be fighters. That's what they don't want in their midst, is fighters who might turn against Egypt. So presumably his thinking is, kill the boys, and we will have eliminated the military threat that would come from this ethnic group. And it could be that he wants to spare the girls because they can provide slave labor that's relatively safe slave labor. That is, they can do work for Egyptian society, but there is less chance that they will rise up in active military rebellion against their rulers. Now, notice that this is interesting in that this can only take effect in the long term. On the short term, by doing this, the Pharaoh hasn't eliminated any of the military threat. None of those baby boys would join in a rebellious activity against Egypt. It would only be later on that they would be a threat. So he's still looking at the long term, a threat that's out there that needs to be dealt with before it becomes a greater problem. Umberto Casuto, who I've mentioned before and I will mention many times again, he makes an interesting observation here, and I'm not sure what to do with this. He points out that in Genesis 12:12, there's an incident where Abraham and Sarah have gone down to Egypt. And this is one of the two times that Abraham tells his wife that she is to say that she is his sister, and he will say that he is her brother, because he's afraid that if he says that she is his wife, that because she is beautiful, the Egyptians would kill him and allow his wife to live. To spare himself an early demise, he asks his wife Sarah to cooperate and to call herself his sister. Casuto says at this point, the parallelism is apparently intended by Scripture in accordance with its principle that the experience of the fathers foreshadow those of the descendants. It's an interesting observation. I'm not entirely convinced that that's intended here, but it is an interesting observation that he's making. That is to say that there are events that occur that the patriarchs experience that are replicated in the life of Israel. And he thinks that this is one of those. Okay. So that's the action that the king has taken. He has commanded the midwives, they are to make sure that all of the baby boys are killed. Why would the king take this action? Why would he have the babies killed by the midwives? Why wouldn't he just have his soldiers come in and kill them? And I think that the answer is he's trying to accomplish his ends with the least social disruption. So I think that he's trying to do this clandestinely to one degree or another because he's afraid of what kind of reaction it might bring if he were to be more aggressive and more overt. The midwives refused to do what the Pharaoh commanded them to do. And it says it's because they feared the Lord. And it repeats that phrase, because they feared the Lord, two times in this section. So that's obviously being emphasized. This suggests then that within the sons of Israel, a memory of the God of their fathers has been retained. That the God who had come and spoken to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and had made those promises, that God is remembered and still revered, at least to some degree, within the sons of Israel. It is interesting to note that the mother of Moses, we haven't come to her yet in the narrative, and when we do come to her, it's interesting, she is not named. It's only later in the genealogies that she is named. But her name is Jochebed, and the first syllable, Yah, stands for Yahweh. So even in the names, they have retained a memory of the God who spoke to the patriarchs. And the action of the midwife suggests that they had also retained a respect for the values of that God and were unwilling to step over the boundaries of those values that God stands for. Now, this is an interesting one because God hasn't given them the law yet. He hasn't spelled out for them what his values are. But I think that it is clear from even the Genesis narrative that God stood for certain values. The God who came to Abraham stood for certain values, and that he wanted those who were his children to stand for those same values. Abraham knew that Sodom and Gomorrah were wicked. He didn't have to be told. So he understands that there are values of right and wrong that exist in the world, and that the God that he worships stands for those values of goodness. And I would assume that that's what's in play here, that the midwives know that there are certain values that are just built into being human beings, and one of those is taking the life of an innocent is wrong. And as a result, they refuse to carry out the command of the Pharaoh. They do not kill the boys that are born. They allow them to live. Now, their action, it seems to me, was extremely brave, given the disparity, given the fact that these are nobodies, and they were commanded by a king who was revered as a god to do this, and they refused to do so. It is pointed out that this is the oldest act of civil disobedience that we have recorded. It is interesting. It says, apparently, God acted on their behalf. God spared them the wrath of the king. There's no indication the king took action against them. I don't know why he didn't take action. It could be that he didn't want it to become known what he had tried to do. And it could be that he decided they just weren't worth the trouble. I don't know. The reason that they acted as they did was because they feared God, as I pointed out. That's repeated two times. Stuart says in his commentary, in short, fearing God is commonly in Scripture a virtual abbreviation for believing in God and therefore fearing the consequences of not pleasing Him, thus being a person of moral conviction and righteous actions. Although in Hebrew it is surely not per se an abbreviation, but an idiom. The women defend themselves, and the excuse that they give is the midwives were unable, and here it says the midwives, which, and they are saying this, and that's why I suspect that they are just two who organized the other midwives, and there were other midwives that were involved. That before the midwives could get there, because the Hebrew women were so vigorous, the birth happened so quickly that the midwives could not get there in time to kill the child before it was already being embraced by the family. It's interesting here that their excuse has an implied criticism of their Egyptian overlords, that their Egyptian overlords are too soft. And the Hebrews, who are slaves, are strong and vigorous. Now, we'll talk about this later, but from my perspective, they lied. We'll talk about this more, but I think that's very interesting. The reason that they give, it might contain some truth, but it's certainly not the whole truth. They are certainly not being straightforward here. Okay. So what the Pharaoh had tried failed. It failed dismally. None of the babies were killed, as far as we know, in this effort. So the Israelites multiplied and became mighty, continued to grow in numbers, and so the problem that the Pharaoh was trying to address, it is just becoming a bigger problem. It's not being solved at all. So the king takes another measure. So this is his fourth measure that he's taken to deal with the Israelite problem. And this one, I forgot, I need to talk a little bit more about the midwives. It is interesting that it says that God rewarded them in verse 21. And it came about because the midwives feared God that he established households for them. Stuart, in his commentary, says that midwives were generally drawn from, chosen from, those women who were childless. If that's true, then in all likelihood, these women were childless. And yet God, in recognition of what they've done, he gives them households. Much like the wives of the patriarchs in Genesis, all of them were barren for a number of years, And then only in their later years did they give birth to a child. And here the midwives are repeating that pattern. God has rewarded them. The solution that the Pharaoh had attempted here by enlisting the help of the midwives was clearly a desperate kind of act to undertake. Clearly, it would have been discovered before too long that the midwives were up to something. If you have that many baby boys dying at birth, somebody's going to figure that out. And then they would have quit calling the midwives. So it seems to me that it was a really short-sighted attempt on his part, but it failed nevertheless, completely. So another attempt, his fourth attempt then. The Pharaoh is going to speak to all of the people, and it's here for the first time that he is referred to as Pharaoh in this narrative. He's been referred to as the king up to now, but now he's referred to as the Pharaoh. And as I pointed out last week, I'm not sure why that changes. I am sure that it's significant. I'm just not sure what the significance is. But my best guess is that he uses king, the author uses king, when he's talking about the powerful head of state, and he uses the term Pharaoh when he's indicating the leader of the Egyptians specifically. The Pharaoh then speaks to his people and commands them, and I think he's exasperated this part. He doesn't know exactly how to proceed from here. But he speaks to the whole people, and he says, all of you Egyptians, whenever you see that a baby boy has been born to the Israelites, take that baby and throw him into the water, throw him into the Nile. He doesn't make any change in who is to be killed, so it's the same as his target demographic that he was using before with the midwives. The only thing that's changed is who's supposed to do it and how they're supposed to do it. They're supposed to take those babies and fling them in the Nile. Now, why throw them into the Nile? Why not bring in his troops and stab baby boys? I don't know the answer to that question. There are a lot of questions I don't know the answers to. But it is interesting, and I think worthy of note, that the taking of another human being's life, I think, is always traumatic to one degree or another. Even people that go to war and are fighting for a just cause, killing other people is an ordeal, even when it has to be done. And I think that this is probably in recognition of that fact. I remember reading about Hitler's final solution. And when he first started large-scale killing of Jews, he used SS soldiers to do that. But after a while, he discontinued that practice because it was causing so many psychological problems in those soldiers. And that's when Hitler started using Jews in the camps to do the killing of other Jews. So it's recognition of how traumatic it is to take a life. And I suspect that what he's trying to accomplish here is he wants to kill those baby boys in the most antiseptic way possible. Just throw them in the river. There's no blood. There's no trauma. The babies just drown probably very quickly. In any case, that is the course of action that he chose. Okay, the next section. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. And his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile, with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. Now, I'll read the rest of this account. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister called to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I shall give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, "Because I drew him out of the water." In this early part of Exodus, figuring out what events occur when is extremely difficult because we don't have many clues. As we get further into Exodus, a lot of events are tied to the age of Moses. And so you can start getting a sense of what happens when and what kind of time frame you're looking at. But here we don't have that. It's not clear when Moses is born. Is Moses born early when the midwives were supposed to be killing the boys? Or is Moses born when all of the Egyptians are supposed to be on the lookout for baby boys to be thrown into the river? It's just not clear. My suspicion is that this is the account that we have is chronological. Now, I say that my suspicion because I'm convinced that in these historical narratives, they are not always chronological, and they will deviate from that sometimes. But in this case, I suspect that it is chronological, that Moses is born at this period of time when all of the baby boys are to be thrown in the river by any Egyptian who finds them. Both of Moses' parents were from the tribe of Levi. Very interesting. That becomes significant later when the Levites are designated as the priestly family, the priestly tribe. All of the priests of Israel will come from the tribe of Levi. So it is interesting then that Moses and Aaron are doubly Levitic. There are no dreams or prophecies that are recorded here that precede the birth of Moses. And yet, Moses' parents seem to have the perspective that there's something special about Moses. It says in the Hebrew text that his mother saw that he was good. And the word that's used for good here is the word that is generally used for either good or beautiful. It's a very common word in Hebrew. But when that was translated into the Greek, they used the word osteos, which is not the typical word for good in Greek. In fact, it's an unusual word. It does not occur very often. And osteos is related to one of the words in Greek for city. And so osteos means sophisticated, or sometimes it can mean charmed or gifted. And that is the word then that's used by Stephen in his account in Acts 7. It's also used in Hebrews chapter 11. Osteos is the word that's used in both of those contexts, probably imitating the Septuagint. But I suspect the translators were capturing something, and that is, it wasn't that he was just good looking. There is something really special about him. Just by looking at him, they can see some kind of charisma or something like that. Because there are indications later on that his parents think that he is something special, and we'll see those later. And it's possible that the wording here is echoing what is used in Genesis chapter 1, when it says that Moses' mother looked and saw that he was good. That phrasing is the same as what you find in Genesis chapter 1, when God looks at the parts of creation that he has made, and he saw that it was good. So I think that we are to see Moses as being something truly special here, something that I've used the phrase full of grace in this context. In any case, his parents are determined that they are going to make it possible for this son, Moses, to survive under the circumstances that the Pharaoh has created. And the text tells us that for 3 months they were able to keep him quiet. And I can just imagine, can you imagine a baby, and every time the baby cries, somebody dashes and somehow muffles the noise. Now, archaeologically, It appears that the city in which they were located was divided into quarters, and that the Hebrew slaves were living in one part of the city and the Egyptians were living in another part of the city. So it's probably that kind of circumstance in which they're living, that if a child cries, that probably does not always mean that there will be trouble. It depends if there are any Egyptians that happen to be in earshot at the time that that happens. Now, the portion that follows is looked upon by some as folklore because it seems highly improbable. And everything goes just right for Moses that makes it possible for him to survive. And it is similar to other stories that are known from the ancient world. And I have just a little section of a story about Sargon. Sargon was a ruler who in the 3rd millennium B.C. became the king of Akkad in Mesopotamia. And I'll just read you this little section from his account of his own life. Sargon, the mighty king, king of Akkad, am I. My mother was a changeling. My father I knew not. My brother of my father loved the hills. My city is Azu-Prianu, which is situated on the banks of the Euphrates. My mother, the high priestess, conceived me. In secret, she bore me. She set me in a basket of rushes with bitumen. She sealed my lid. She cast me into the river, which rose not over me. And you can see the similarities there. As soon as he's born, he's put into a basket. It's a reed basket, sealed with tar, and then a lid put on it. All of those are the same as what we have in our account. And then it's put into a river. And I can go on. He is found by a gardener who takes him in and raises him, and then eventually he becomes the king. There are other similar stories in the ancient world that have some of these same characteristics. And it is concluded from that, that the Moses account is just folklore that is imitating these other folk tales. But obviously, it's not necessarily folklore. It seems to me that the folklore could have come about through God's activity, his creation through creative human beings, and ends up setting the stage for the Moses that does come. Because in reading the Moses account, I should point out that these stories, like this one of Sargon, almost invariably, the person who's put into the basket eventually ends up being a king. So as you're reading the story of Moses, if you're familiar with those tales, you know that Moses is going to turn out to be a king or something like a king. So it's possible that what's going on here is God, in crafting history, the novel that is history, has drawn upon literary devices that pre-existed to help him to paint the picture that he wants to paint. Okay, I find this puzzling, especially if I put myself in the place of Moses' parents, as to what do you do and what kind of sense does it make to put your baby in a basket? What are the chances of that turning out well? There are some who argue that probably, they're hypothesizing, probably putting a baby in a basket and setting it in the Nile is like what developed in our culture 100 years or so ago when people would place unwanted babies on the steps of a church. That was kind of a sign. That was that this baby is here to be taken care of by someone. It is an unwanted child. But as far as I know, there's no concrete evidence that that was the case. Some have speculated that Moses' parents knew that the Pharaoh's daughter bathed in that location in the Nile and put the basket there so that the Pharaoh's daughter would find it. That I'm not real happy with that solution. How would you know that the Pharaoh's daughter would treat it kindly? How would you know the Pharaoh's daughter wouldn't just take it out of the basket and throw it in the water like her father has commanded? As I'm trying to think through, what are they thinking? My best guess is that what's happening is they are in this ghetto area where Israelites live, and that Egyptians come through by occasion, and that it could be that what they're thinking is whenever an Egyptian comes into our area, we will go hide the baby in the river. That for short periods of time then, the baby is in the basket in the river with a lid on it to help muffle the sound. But I'm speculating. We don't know. The author doesn't really tell us why they thought that this was a good course of action. And they're in desperate circumstances in any case, so it's hard to know what would be a better course of action. The chances are that the baby would be found and would be put to death. In any case, for whatever reasons, they thought this was a good choice of action. They took a basket, this basket that's made out of reeds. They make it watertight by sealing it with tar. They put a lid on it, and I think that's more to make it soundproof and I assume to provide protection from the sun. I mean, I think about putting a baby out in a basket in the Nile. It can't be there very long. And before too long, it's going to need attention. So if it just seems like a really difficult situation and one that's unlikely to succeed. But I think they're temporarily putting it in the river. They put his sister on guard duty to watch and see what happens to make sure that nothing bad happens to the baby. And I suspect that the Pharaoh's daughter coming along is a surprise to her. She's just there, and she has to be quite young. She's there watching the basket. The Pharaoh's daughter comes along. The Pharaoh's daughter sends her maid to look at, to see what's in this basket. The maid goes out and gets the basket, and they open it up, and they look inside, and there's a little baby boy there. The Pharaoh's daughter at this point uses the word na'ar, which is the Hebrew word for a young boy, but it's usually like a teenager, so it's unusual for this word to be used to refer to an infant. But Robert Alter says that this word can have the connotation of a vulnerable child, so like a waif. So here in the basket is a waif. Behold, a waif. And they look at it, and it is immediately clear to the daughter of Pharaoh that this is a Hebrew. And something that I did not know previously, the Egyptians circumcised their boys also. But as I understand it, they circumcised differently. And they just notched the foreskin rather than cutting it off. So she would have been able to tell just by looking that this is a Hebrew child. This is not an Egyptian child. She has pity on the child. She wants to take it home. Miriam, his sister, comes running down and says, "Do you need someone to nurse this baby?" So if she had no idea that Pharaoh's daughter would come along, she is very bright and thinking very quickly. And Pharaoh's daughter says, "That's a great idea." And Miriam says, "Well, I have just the person for it." And she goes and gets her mother, and her mother then is hired to nurse her own son, which is, I think, an amazing act of grace on God's part. So Moses' mother then is able to raise Moses in his early years until he's weaned and then given back to Pharaoh's daughter. Now, the scholars say that typically that would be at about age 2 that the child would be weaned and then given back to the adopted mother. I'm suspicious that that's too early. I mean, I don't know, but it is clear from the account that Moses grows up strongly identifying with the Israelites. And I think there are indications that Moses has learned quite a bit about his heritage. Now, he could have learned that in his education, that's true, but where he learned that strong sense of identification with his people, I don't think he would have learned that by the age of 2. So I suspect there would have been some ongoing contact between Moses' mother and Moses, even past the age of 2, whether she continues to raise him full time or whether it's intermittent. But I just have to think that there is some kind of contact taking place. But at some point then, he is taken away from his mother and he becomes the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And she names him Moses. And as I pointed out last week, these words with different meanings, different significances, keep showing up, and it does here as well. Moses was a very common name in the royal family in Egypt. There are a number of the pharaohs that were named Moses or had Moses as a part of their name. And in Egyptian, it meant the one who is born, and that's very significant. It's the one who is born with a sense of a destiny, an important destiny that awaits them. So she names him Moses, which would have been a typical name for the dynastic family, very appropriate. But the word Moses is very similar in sound to the Hebrew that means he who draws out. And she says when she names him Moses, because I drew him out of the water. So she's taking an Egyptian name that she gives him because it sounds like a Hebrew phrase that means I took him out of the water. But it means more precisely, he who draws out, which is extremely interesting because we have Moses coming along and being the one who draws the Israelites out of Egypt. So there's a lot going on in these names that have been given to Moses. Okay, a few comments, and I will try to do this quickly. There are a number of commentators who, in talking about the actions of the midwives, that when they spoke to Pharaoh, they say that they lied, those midwives lied, and they condemned them for it. That includes, and that's especially the older commentators, Augustine takes that perspective, Calvin takes that perspective, and there are many others. There are other commentators who say, well, it's not really a lie. That was the case, that what happened was the Hebrew women gave birth so fast that the midwives couldn't get there in time, and that is the real reason why they were unable to carry out the king's command. But if that's the case, that the women gave birth too quickly, why have midwives at all? If the child's born and embraced by the family and everything, then the midwife is always showing up too late. It seems from my perspective, even if that is the case, they didn't tell Pharaoh the whole story because the narrative makes it clear that they did this out of a motivation of fear of God. I think, therefore, that there is a sense in which they clearly lied. That the way I think about lying, it certainly is not a straightforward and complete explanation of the situation. There are some commentators that say that God did not approve of the lie. They agree that it was a lie, and God did not approve of the lie, but he did approve of their respect for God, and that's why he rewarded them. But it seems to me that we are to see their actions as a whole as heroic, including what they say to the Pharaoh. And we see that he gives them households. They are named in the text, which rarely happens. They are remembered then by tradition within the Israelite tradition. And that raises the question then, if it's true that they lied, and if it's true that they are rewarded for their actions and that there is no sense of condemnation for that, then is lying appropriate? And I have thought about this on a number of occasions, trying to sort out what is lying wrong, and if so, under what circumstances is it wrong? I think, and we will get to this later in Exodus, and I'll have to look at it again, but I think that the commandment against false witness is different from lying. The false witness is something in a judicial context where there is punishment at stake. But what is a lie and what constitutes a lie? If any statement that is an incomplete answer is a lie, Is it appropriate to give an incomplete answer? Is it appropriate to give a diplomatic answer? If my granddaughter brings to me a painting that she has just created and she says, isn't this beautiful? Can I say yes when it isn't? That's what I mean by a diplomatic answer. If we sort out all of those things which could be lies, it gets really complicated and cloudy, and it's hard to know when a lie would be appropriate and when it is not appropriate. And the best that I can do with respect to answering this question is I think there are two principles that are involved. The first is, as followers of a God of truth, we should be devoted to truth. Truth is important. Truth matters. We need to take it seriously. The second principle, though, is that we live in the real world, and that does create its own set of complications. And I think that the most significant factor here is, what is the nature of the context in which I am speaking? One of the teachers at PBC eons ago, who was talking about the hypothetical situation that I'm sure you've all heard about and have probably thought about, and that is, what if you are in Germany during the time of Hitler, you have hidden some Jews in your house, and the Nazis come to the door and knock on the door and say, do you have any Jews here? And if you answer that question, yes, you have sealed the fate of the Jews that you have hidden in your house. His thinking about that was, what you need to do is respond to the intent of the questioner. And the intent of the questioner is essentially, do you have any Jews here that I can kill? If taken in that whole context, that's actually what's happening with the question. And one needs to respond to the whole context of the question. And therefore, strictly speaking, in that kind of situation, a lie is justifiable. I think that's helpful, but it's a difficult principle to apply, I think. So I don't know the answer to the question, when is it legitimate to lie? I think we have an instance here in Exodus where lying was done and it was legitimate. But I think we must always keep in mind, from God's perspective, what is the most helpful, what is the most constructive way that we can respond and represent ourselves. And if we're going to lie, we need to know that we stand accountable before God in doing so. And for people who are devoted to the truth is always ultimately in our favor. And we shouldn't be fearful of standing up for what is true. Now, in thinking about this, I started reflecting more generally on the situation that at least I am very aware of in our current cultural context. It seems to me that we are living in a time when traditional values are eroding away in many respects. And I keep thinking, what is my role in a situation where values that I hold to be good, and I would say not all of traditional values are good, but many of them are, the ones that I am convinced are good, what is my responsibility with respect to those? What do I need to do? And I feel myself torn in two directions. One direction is, and the one that is easy, is capitulate. We can see where the trends are going. We can see what is happening to the values that once were held near and dear. A lot of those are eroding away, and with an enormous amount of cultural force. And we all are aware of how strong that cultural force is. And the easy thing to do is to capitulate and find a way to justify to myself, no, I can make some adjustments to this value, whatever it is, whether it's lying or whether it's abortion, homosexuality, any number of things. Fear that, because I know that how strong that is, and I fear compromising my values. So my second response is, dig in my heels. I'm just going to take a stand. And the problem with that is, in my own experience, what I've seen is, let's just use the example of lying. I would have said some time ago, and I don't remember how long ago, but some time ago, I would have said that lying is always wrong, such that if that Nazi comes to my door and asks if there are any Jews here, I'd say, yep, they're back in the closet. We need to, as we become wiser and more understanding how our values need to play out in the real world, there are adjustments that should be made. And to just dig in my heels for the sake of digging in my heels is probably no better than capitulating. So I'm stuck in this difficult tension. At what points do I adjust my understanding of my values? And at what points do I really hold strong? And I find that a constant tension and one that I find very difficult. But I am convinced that we can't just do one or the other. We can't just capitulate for the sake of capitulating, nor can we just dig in our heels for the sake of digging in our heels. We have to work through the problem as best we can and trust that God is in charge even of our thought processes and will bring us along as he sees fit. But recognizing the difficulty of this seems to me means that we need to grant one another a great deal of latitude with respect to this issue. That some people are going to draw the line one place, and some other people are going to draw the line in a different place, and I'm convinced that equally reasonable and godly people will end up drawing the line with respect to different values at different places. But even if they won't, you can understand the difficulty of the process. And as a result, we need to be very, very understanding of other people's process and understand that things are not black and white. And I'm convinced that as time goes on, that many of us, if not all of us, are going to be put into situations where we are going to have to decide where we stand with respect to various values that are being challenged in our society, in our time. And we're going to have to decide where we need to stand and what it means to keep the faith. And I think that's going to be difficult. And there's going to be a price to be paid that we're going to have to face into and take into account. And in that situation, we are going to especially need the understanding and support of those around us. And as a result, it seems to me, we need to grant one another a great deal of latitude as we're all struggling with those kinds of issues. There was more that I was going to talk about, but I'm out of time, so I won't. And since we're over time, I won't open it up for questions. But there is an enormous amount of stuff here that we could talk about further, I think, with benefit. So if you have questions, please write them down. And then next week, I think I'll start with time for questions to allow that to happen. I really think that this has enormous relevance for our times, and it raises lots of issues. So if you have questions, I think we should talk about them. Okay, thanks.